So yeah, as I did say yesterday, we would look at the final spiritual faculty samadhi. Look at that this afternoon. Look at what it covers and how it relates to different practices, including this one, this more receptive way of practicing. But this morning, I put it this way around because this morning I want to look at quite a big topic, quite a big aspect of our experience. So I thought we'd need a little bit more time for exploration. So it's another aspect of mind, mindfulness, watching the mind. Yesterday we looked at thoughts and thinking and also mood, the general mood in the mind. And today we're going to look a bit more at emotions, and particularly emotions fueled by craving and aversion. So sometimes called the poisons or the afflictions, which I've already mentioned. So the meditation teacher, Dharma teacher, American teacher, Steve Armstrong, says, "Your mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Don't go there alone. Take mindfulness with you." So this is pointing to the protective nature of mindfulness, you know, protecting us from danger zones or this dangerous neighborhood that the mind can wander into at times. And what's dangerous are the klesha or kilesa, the mind states that distort our perception through craving or through aversion. The Pali words are lobha and dosa. I rather like the Pali words, so I'll probably use them a bit. And delusion or moha, which I particularly like, probably look at probably tomorrow. Look at wisdom and delusion, panya and moha tomorrow. So when these, in a way, dangerous states of mind, or they distort our perception, we can't see clearly. So we can't see objectively. There's a bias in the mind towards wanting. Wanting will distort what's being seen, or not wanting. Those are the two sort of flavors of experience. That we're looking at this morning. There are obviously the skillful and positive emotions, love and generosity, harmony and truthfulness. But we're particularly looking at those that if you like, distort our perceptions. And once they've distorted our perception, if you like, we've got a free run to acting on them. The mind feels something quite strongly. It wants something quite strongly. And craving, in a way, reinforces itself, says, go for it. So that there's less sort of, when there's less mindfulness, there's less positive sort of restraint on what's helpful for practice, what's helpful for the mind. What doesn't lead to suffering. Craving is not interested in that. It's interested in doing its thing, which is wanting. And the same with aversion, if you like, or not wanting. They have their own power, their own nature. Just like the nature of thinking is to think, the nature of craving is to crave. And the same with aversion. And often acting, I know my own experience, acting on those strong emotions that can feel quite sort of right at the time, quite convincing, at the time. There's often regret afterwards. It might be something as innocent as having seconds at dinner time, or a second piece of cake, or whatever it is that's slightly less innocent. There's all sorts of levels, but the basic mechanism is the same for wanting, pulling things towards us, not wanting, pushing things away. So often there is a level of recognition, there's a level of awareness, and our ethical framework will quite often help us not act on things that are clearly, what did the puja say, that of causing affliction either to ourselves or to others or to both self and other. But we can also, with mindfulness, we can learn to see them really quickly. We can learn to see them as they arise, if we're able to be present. And so we have a chance to influence those mind states before they grow really big and strong, before the mind becomes this dangerous neighbourhood. So what the Buddha says in relation to these klesha and the suffering that they cause is quite counterintuitive. We don't suppress it. We don't suppress the wanting or not wanting. We don't indulge it and fall headlong into it. We simply stay with it. So we can learn from it and see it for what it is. It's a temporary mind state that's conditioned or fueled by certain habits, by how we've responded in the past through our life. It arises, it happens, and when the fuel runs out, it ends. We can learn to watch that whole process moment to moment. So this is a wisdom practice. This is a practice of learning to be with and understand the nature of different mind states and their relationship to suffering or freedom from suffering. So we bring right view and awareness to bear. And we observe with interest and awareness. And we also, if we're present moment to moment, we can also recognize what the mind is like when klesha, when defilements are not present. What does the mind feel like in those moments? So you can understand something about the nature of those minds where things other than klesha are present. So I want to say a little bit about the manifestations, I suppose particularly in meditation, of craving and aversion. I know that you will all be very familiar with many manifestations, but there are some that are perhaps more relevant to meditation. But I'll cover a spectrum. So let's start with aversion. So this includes irritation, grumpiness, resentment, anger, resistance, fault-finding mind, a mind that's tight and closed. Boredom comes into boredom is a not wanting the experience that we're having. And what I was calling this can't be bothered mind. So not engaging, not bothering. This could be more in the spectrum of moha or delusion, but there's usually an aspect of not wanting the experience. So this is probably the easiest poison for most of us to recognize, because it hurts, and so we want to minimize it, change it, make it go away. So it also includes things like fear and sadness and disappointment. And these might be a little bit more surprising. Those states, it's interesting, isn't it, that the mind is such that it often divides something into things that are the more acceptable version of something. So it's quite straightforward in a way. You think, oh, the aversive mind, the critical mind, the fault-finding mind. It's easy to see those as aversion. A bit less easy maybe to see sadness or disappointment. But there's still an argument with how things are. There's still a non-acceptance of what's happening in that moment. But I think that tendency to split is almost like making some aspects of the aversive spectrum okay and some not okay. Whereas with mindfulness, they're all okay in a certain sense. They're all the same. We relate to them in the same way. They're simply there to be recognized for what they are, for what they feel like. So if we start dividing them into the ones that are more acceptable or allowable and the ones that are less, we miss the point that actually, can I be with this, whatever it is? Can I simply notice what's happening and what it feels like, what this manifestation of aversion, how it thinks, how it feels in the body? So in meditation, it's quite often manifest as things like frustration or impatience. We're seeing what's wrong with our practice or what's not good enough. There's not enough concentration, there's not enough peacefulness, you name it. So judging, comparing, working to correct or interfere with what's actually happening. It's usually happening because there's some degree of non-acceptance of what's happening. Impatience is interesting, really interesting to notice whether you might notice the quality of patience in the mind. And what that's saying is that there's a lack of aversion. Actually, I think impatience straddles both impatience and because you want something else to be there or don't want something to be in your experience. So we can notice what's feeding aversion in the mind in terms of the thoughts, unpleasant thoughts or memories or sensations in the body. And what are the conditions that keep it going? So we can understand how dosa, how aversion is working in the mind. So again, that image of the naturalist, we're just looking to see what's happened in the mind's natural environment. Okay, so a little bit about manifestations of craving. Loba, wanting. So actually, a little quote first from someone called Joseph Needleman. He says, greed is inevitable in the absence of an inner aim. Greed is inevitable in the absence of an inner aim. Those aims can be different, but what it's pointing to is set of values that are not about self-interest. They're about something other or something more than simply our own desires. I like to, in this particular practice, I like to quote it with that inner aim being the Dhamma perspective of right view. So that pointing north, or that spiritual sort of compass, going in the direction of awakening. Yeah, so maybe one other thing to say in relation to lobha, to craving, and moha, delusion. So in the Pali Canon, there's an image of two sheaves of wheat that are leaning against each other. And these, it's a slightly different model, but these point to the relationship between craving and delusion. They mutually support each other. Actually, it is the same for aversion too. So you take one away and they both fall down. But lobha is said to be the more effective aspect of delusion. So it's more to do with these afflictive states. But moha is more to do with the cognitive aspect of delusion. So and more to do with views, wrong views. And it's often the wrong views that maintain the afflictive or unskillful emotions. So if lobha is in the mind, moha will also be there. Very simply. So, longing, wishing, hoping, wanting, this over-eagerness in the mind and in the body. You can feel some of these, can't you, the leaning forward or leaning into. A sort of enchantment with the desired object. It really takes us over in a certain way. So we can't see clearly. Subhuti says something like, he says, you take an object, you blow its pleasurable aspects out of proportion, forget about its painful downside. You think that by having the object you will secure your ego identity. By attaching yourself to the object, you think you will enhance your ego identity. You'll be happy, solid, secure. This is craving. So for me, it's the bit about taking the pleasurable aspects and just really forgetting about the other side. This sort of enchantment with what we're wanting or liking. Seeking more. There's often a sense of more with lobha. And in meditation, there can be a lot of striving. We can associate striving with a good thing, but actually we need to be checking the mind to notice whether our striving, our effort, if you like, is influenced by lobha. Sayadaw Ottajeni in Burma says that effort is easily corrupted by craving. Craving sort of hops on the back of effort with its own agenda. So ambition, spiritual ambition, can manifest as a strong wanting something to happen. One I find very interesting is expectations. Expectations are about an idea of what we want to happen. Any sentence that has that word want is usually to do with craving. So something that we want to happen that's not actually happening. So just staying right with present moment experience. From this perspective, we can notice rather than be caught up in the wanting mind. Bhante talks about hankering, which is a rather nice word. Hankering after any pleasurable external or internal object, taking it as pleasing to oneself. So So craving, it wants, and those wants, they will lead to suffering. It's harder to see with craving, I think. But wisdom wants too. So there are different sorts of wants, if you like. So wisdom is more likely to want what's best for the situation. It doesn't have this self-reference framework. It's a much more open framework. It's very hard to be objective, to have that clarity infused with metta that we were talking about yesterday, when there's craving in the mind, when there's lobha. At best, there are mixed motivations. So I think in relation to the wisdom mind, often with craving, perhaps there's a desire for results. Touched on this before. And the wisdom mind, there's just a desire to practice. There's this distinction between kama chanda, desire for sense experience, and dhamma chanda, desire for the dhamma. But desire for the dhamma is not things like goal orientation, willfulness, or trying really hard. There's something much more open, and it's able to take in much more. That desire, that expectation, will close things down. Wanting something in particular closes you down from all the other possibilities that there are. And with Dharma practice, I think I said right at the beginning, this being open to the unknown is really important. If we just have what we know, we're quite limited. So our own expectations and desires can only really be based on what we know or what we have an idea about. Just being open to what's actually happening in our experience means there are infinite possibilities, things that we don't yet know. Maybe I'll just tell you a couple of stories from my own experience, and then a bit later I'll say a bit more about particularly working in relation to right view. But just to give a bit more of a sense of how you might work. Maybe put it in the framework of the hindrances. A lot of our practice, when there's something in the mind that we're not, that's one of these dangerous zones, that's an aspect of craving or aversion, then we've got this framework of the hindrances. There are different things we can do. We can cultivate the opposite. We can do various other things which escape my mind at the moment. We could go for refuge, of course. What we do before we do any of those things is recognize what's happening clearly. And sometimes I think we can skip over that stage quite quickly and move to antidote before really taking in what is this hindrance? What is this thing that's arisen in the mind? What's that like? Clearly knowing, clearly recognizing that before skipping over to the fix. And that's where sometimes we can have a bit of aversion to what's in the mind. The part of our antidoting can be wanting it to go away, wanting something different to be present. So, so I want to, maybe tell you a story about working with aversion, and this was quite a big aversion, if you like. So I was in Burma, second time I was there, and I had a good friend, and we fell out, this good friend and I. And we tried to talk about it, and that it just made things worse. It was one of those things, you know, you try and talk about it and you think, why did I bother? This did not help at all. The slightly awkward thing was that we were with a group of friends, but we were due to get on a bus together and take an overnight 12-hour journey back to the meditation centre. So we had to sit next to each other, not touching, not talking, and it was pretty uncomfortable. So we got back to the meditation centre, and she slipped a note under my door. Shall we meet? Shall we meet to talk? Try again. And I just had these two responses, these two big responses. One was, well, I knew I didn't want to meet. I sort of couldn't really bear the thought. I had a very strong aversion to it. And I actually had the thought, I go home in a week's time. Maybe we could just sort of not really talk and I could just go away and never see her again. So I had this strong aversion and this desire to run away. And then on the other hand, I had the thought, well, this is no good. I ought to talk to her. I really should just try and talk to her. So there was what I thought I should do. It was what I called my good Buddhist hat. So I had my strong aversion and my good Buddhist. This is what I should do. And they both seemed quite. They were both problematic and weren't really what I wanted to do, but I was very caught in these two reactions. So I decided, well, I've been working with this practice. Why am I not thinking in those terms? Thinking of so, and I realized that I'd sort of excluded this because it felt so strong. I could feel it right through my body. And not really knowing quite why we clashed or why I felt so sort of upset and agitated by it. And clearly she was feeling pretty similar. So I bought myself some time. I slipped a note under her door, left a note saying, I'm not quite ready. Could we just leave it a couple of days or leave it a bit of time and I'll let you know. And she wrote back and said, yes, that's fine. So then I just sat with all this aversion. And initially all this feeling of, the feeling I should talk to her dropped away quite quickly. And with it dropped away a sense of judgment. I'm dealing with this. Not in either of those two ways, but there's another option. And this option is simply to sit with what's happening. So I sat with the aversion. And I would notice how certain thoughts about her or about the interaction, certain thoughts would go, make my body go, and it was like fire. It's like those thoughts were like fuel being thrown on a fire. And every time it sort of damped down, another sort of thought, or I'd get caught in a little story and it would go, it would just rise up like, I don't know what, Guy Fawkes or something. And this was all very interesting, just noticing what was happening, recognizing aversion as aversion really clearly. This is what aversion feels like in the mind. That was the aspect of right view, if you like. Clearly knowing this is aversion happening in the mind. these are thoughts about, and seeing that relationship between thoughts, feelings, and what was happening in the body. And, you know, I did get caught in the story quite often, and then I'd come back to present moment and recognise it as a story, feel how agitated my body and mind were. And I sat with this for about a day and a half. It was quite intense, but that was my practice during that time, was just sitting, being with, but being able to observe at least some of the time the nature of the aversive mind. And gradually, the thoughts started to change. And this was not because I was doing anything to make them change. I started having thoughts like, I wonder if when she said that, she meant that. And this had a different effect on the body, or effect on the fuel sort of stayed quite sort of low. And the mind started making connections. It was a bit calmer, up and down, but with keeping the awareness, keeping the right view perspective, the mind was starting to make its own connections that didn't have all this aversion sort of attached to them. So rather than trying to think my way out of the mind states, the emotion, the klesha, it came about by itself. It came about because right view and awareness were working in the mind. And they're able to do their own job, if you like. Aversion was doing its job. Awareness and right view were also allowed in there to do their own work. And they did. They did. And after this about just under 2 days, maybe, I knocked on her door and we had a little chat. And it was absolutely fine. I was still slightly nervous. I still had that degree. But there was much more sort of confidence in the connection was back in play. The fact that we were good friends was back in play. The desire to connect and to understand. So I still didn't quite know why I'd had this really strong reaction. But I did come to understand the nature of aversion more generally, a bit, and see the way it functions, see how it was fueled, particularly how it was fueled by thoughts, how so much suffering came from the thinking process. But actually it didn't really matter that I didn't quite understand why I'd reacted like that and why it had all gone wrong. There was enough understanding okay, that's just how aversion works. It's like energy, it sort of flies up and then calms down again. So eventually the fuel did sort of go out. There was no fuel left, the fire went out. And I was left with quite a lot of confidence in the practice, in the process of getting out of the way, of not trying to control in some way what was happening, but allowing awareness and right view to allowing the process to happen. So there's a big difference, I think, between attempting to control what's happening and, in a way, letting or setting up positive conditions to influence the mind in positive direction. That was the only responsibility I sort of gave myself, was to just set up, these conditions of awareness and right view and be willing to stay with that. And see what happened, be interested in what happened. Yeah, so I gained a lot of confidence and trust in awareness and right view to do that. But I also gained confidence in the friendship, actually, that we could sort of go through that. We're still in touch. I didn't go home and never want to see her again. So that's rather a long story, but it's one that I think hopefully gives you a sense of how actually it's not how the practice can work in quite significant ways. I'll give you another little smaller one, which is just about it's more to do with craving. So it's happened a few years ago. I was just living in Cambridge, cycling home across beautiful Jesus Common, and the thought popped into my head after a long day at work. Oh, I think I'll have a beer when I get home. And then there was another thought, oh, I think my partner was away. So when he's away, I tend to... The routine goes out of the window of it. So it's like, oh, maybe I'll have a takeaway. Mm-hmm. Oh, and a movie. So this whole sort of scenario was setting itself up in my mind quite nicely. And but it was the beer thought that came, that because the other, I think I had a movie at home or a box set or something, but it was the beer, and that would require me stopping at the off license on the way home. So I noticed this beer thought, and then I really clearly noticed the craving in the mind. I think often craving attaches itself to the object. So mentally and emotionally, there's no space. And what mindfulness does is it allows different objects to be seen for themselves, if you like. So there was the object of this thought image of me stopping off at the off license. And then there was this sort of zingy, cravey, craving and liking at the idea of that, the response of that. And I found that really interesting. In fact, I got more interested in the craving than the thought of the beer. And I thought, well, this is interesting. Let's see what happens. I, in a way, didn't really want to just identify with the good thought, if you like, that seen craving quite clearly in that moment. Let's see what happens. I know experience changes moment to moment. And then I had another thought. I had the thought, whatever happens in this process, at some point there will be more interest in simply watching that process, in simply watching the mind. There will be more interest than following through on having a beer. So that was also interesting, seeing there was a confidence in that process, that mind watching process. So I cycled on, mind sort of just open to what happened. What do you think happened? I bought the beer. Yeah, I had a beer. And this was in the general context of I wasn't very... I would prefer, and wanted myself not to like a beer every now and again, but I did. Actually, the reality was that I did. And so I did. And actually, that's important, not that I did, but that what's most important is the learning process, is what's learned along the way. And I knew that moment, those moments of clearer seeing, being really interested in craving, I knew that they would have their effect. And actually years later, I'd done quite a long retreat in Burma, the last time I went there, And at the end, I just thought to myself, there was an opportunity. I think I was going out with, there was an order member who was living in Yangon at the time, and I stayed with him for a little while after this long retreat. And I think there was the opportunity to have a glass of wine or something. And I just had the thought, well, I've just been putting so much time and effort and money into awareness, into strengthening awareness. Do I want to do something that, its nature is conducive to unawareness, even if it, I didn't drink enough to have much of an effect? And I just thought, no, I don't. Actually, no, I don't. And I've hardly drunk since then. There's just recently, there's been a couple of times where I have, but until then, it's probably been 4 or 5 years when it was just not wanted. It was just not wanted and seen through in a particular sort of way. And I do connect that back to some of those moments of just being aware of that relationship around alcohol. Yeah. Obviously, there are many, many, many moments and many stories, but that's just to give you a bit of an idea. I'm sure you have your own moments.